Thanks, everybody. Do take a seat. Thank you very, very much for your contributions and to our speakers for a really fascinating morning. Somebody has helpfully reminded me to let you all know that slides are going to be available after the event, so any details that anyone wasn't quite able to catch, you will be able to do so, and we'll make sure that everybody who's here gets a copy of those. So it's my very great pleasure to welcome Professor Karen Henwood from Cardiff University. Absolutely can't wait what she's got to say about the social science behind some of all of what's going on at the moment. Thank you.
So how do I use this? Okay, good. Okay, well, thank you very much, conference organisers, for asking me to speak on behalf of the Understanding Risk Group, Cardiff University, about the work that we're doing as part of Flexis. Flexis, as we see on the logo, on the strip at the side of the slide. It's a 5-year engineering social science consortium concerned with the whole integrated flexible energy system of the future. Now, obviously, at today's event, the focus of discussion is on a smart future. Whatever we want to describe it as, this future is going to be different in some important ways from the recent past, in terms of using limited environmental and energy resources in the form of fossil fuels very intensively. So there's going to be something different. To some extent, many of us are still living with that past quite comfortably. We're still supplied by energy through gas and electricity from a stable, decentralised grid system. But increasingly, this is becoming less possible to do, and this is posing new technical challenges that will have to be met. Now, Flexis comprises a wide-ranging set of engineering technological development programmes. I'm not talking about those today because I'm a social scientist, and I'm working with engineers about facilitating the transition to a new energy system of the future. Part of the reason I think I'm here today is because the social science of Flexis is actually considered quite important. We're a very small part, but this slide titled Social Acceptability and Responsible Development of Energy Systems is the title for the social science research programme within Flexis, but increasingly I would say that this is what all of us are doing, engineers as well. It's into its second year now, Flexis. It has two overarching and coexisting goals, working out how it might be possible to reconfigure the whole energy system of the future by conducting cutting-edge research, that's one, and demonstrating it in a Welsh context. Increasingly, we are going to be involved in demonstrating the benefits of Flexis research and technical development in a Welsh context. We have a Flexis demonstrator site, which is in Port Talbot Steelworks and the surrounding area, but I'm not talking about that today. So, I don't want to use too much specialist language, but I thought it was worth mentioning that we are, when investigating how to make the transition to the energy system of the future, approaching it as a socio-technical problem space. Partly that reflects the fact that we have among our number scholars of science and technology studies, but increasingly we're expanding this and we're talking about developing our own Flexis problem space. What all this means in practice is that we see the energy system of the future as far from being technologically determined. Rather, it will arise as a dynamic product of what's considerable possible and plausible by engineers, and made to happen in particular ways through programmes of technological development that they're engaged in. But always in ways that will be embedded in social ideas about what's desirable or not, and these ideas are always publicly discussable, as well as being understood and contested in particular ways by people in their everyday lives and worlds. Now, the figure that you see on the right-hand side of the slide at the top there is the energy trilemma figure, which is at the heart of Flexis work. We're seeking to attain an energy future that is low carbon, secure and affordable. That's what the trilemma means. But we also need to find ways to investigate what's a highly complex, interrelated set of dynamics. Flexis Social Science, our work programme, is doing this by mapping out what we're calling our issue space, i.e. the ideas that are being shared within Flexis about what is considered possible, plausible and desirable. And secondly, we're developing deeper ways of understanding the impacts of whole energy systems change in terms of its impacts on members of the public, how they live out their lives now and with reference to the socio-technical futures that are being imagined for them. We're interested in how people live their lives across the life course, and partly that is because we're building into our research some findings that emerged from a 5-year project called Energy Biographies. There is a research report available that I can supply you with, or you can download it from our website. So people live out their lives across the whole of the life course, and this is something that's important to us. Now, potentially, smart energy future initiatives of all kinds are very interesting to us as we look to technical projects that may be in the early stages of becoming more or less embedded in the way society as a whole is organised, and I'm beginning to hear lots about that today. But we're interested in looking at how they're played out when particular developments take off. So there's always that sort of should we, shouldn't we dynamic in terms of whether we're engaging in particular technical projects. So what I'm going to do today is not talk about any particular technical projects amongst the Flexis engineers that we're working with, but I'm going to draw on some empirical research and qualitative data from this recently completed Energy Biographies project. Hopefully, it's going to question some assumptions about smart energy futures in a way which will spark interest and discussion. This slide gets a bit more specific about one area, the smart home, where smart energy is already an issue within the Flexis problem space. Once you start looking at a key issue such as the energy trilemma, the affordability, decarbonising the energy system, keeping it affordable, keeping it secure, one obvious place to start is to ask the question, where are the opportunities and obstacles relating to how people use energy? But we're interested in going a lot further than this, looking at what doesn't obviously meet the eye, things that are taken for granted. And as social scientists, we develop our methodologies to do this so that we can take a really good look at how people reflect on the usually intangible interconnections between their energy usage and the relationships they have with a whole range of everyday objects, such as washing machines and practices, ways of heating the home. But also their relationships with other people, generations, family members, community organisations. All of these are important relationships because they mediate public acceptance of overarching policy shifts by governance and various kinds of institutions that have an influence on their lives. So while we recognise, under the smart homes part of this slide, that smart technology in the home is potentially offering ways of dealing with the trilemma challenges, affordability, security, decarbonising the energy system, we will be looking in a far more methodologically detailed way at what's brought into play once you understand that people have a whole range of feelings framed in a whole range of different ways by societal and cultural dynamics. This is what makes up the smart energy area within our socio-technical problem space and within our Flexis problem space. Okay, so this, we don't have a slide to show you to capture all the issues and dynamics that we're highlighting within Flexis. But I do think this one is quite useful because it immediately suggests that there's something quite complicated underpinning these two core areas of automated energy management and having information available to assist decision-making in real time, which is important in smart homes. So these are all meanings that are relevant if we start to open up the concept of the smart home. We're not startled like that, and I know that people in this room won't be startled because you're very inspired and enthusiastic, which is lovely to hear about. But the reason we're not startled is because the concept of smart and its multiple meanings has been discussed at length by Yolanda Strengers in her work on smart utopias. She underlines how smart as a concept fails to grapple with the kinds of issues that are important for us in our Flexis problem space, how it can eradicate vast areas of human experience, and it can establish lifestyles that enable new and energy-intensive ways of living. She problematises the idea of the idealised resource-limiting energy consumer for creating a particular picture of the future, which is not innocent, it positions actors in relation to one another, and it brings certain issues and benefits and risks to the fore and misses others. and therefore there can be unintended consequences. Just looking at some more research very briefly, a study on smart energy monitors introduced into people's homes, it's quite well known, findings suggesting that the early learning of the kind intended to be beneficial by cutting out unnecessary and wasteful energy consumption could have the unintended consequence in that any further cuts could be resisted. And very quickly, just another example of an unintended consequence from a media report of customer perceptions. The unintended consequence was loss of trust in an energy company. And interestingly, Yolanda Strengers is now doing more work in Australia on how people interact with all sorts of smart appliances in their homes in ways which involve hacking them. So our work, the Energy Biographies Project, very quickly, we did a qualitative longitudinal study involving four community case sites, three of them in Wales, one of them in London, so it's a very large-scale qualitative study. 36 people took part in three interviews over the course of 1 year. That's longitudinal. You engage with people in and through time. We don't just do commando-style models of just talking to people in a one-off way. Participants undertook a lot of activities, taking photographs and then reflecting on those photographs. And they were also shown videos of imagined future homes, including a range of technological interventions, and I'm going to show you some data from that. So, we were asking people to reflect on their smart homes by showing them films which pictured future visions in two different temporal horizons. One of the films was made in the 1950s, the Monsanto House of the Future. One was made by Channel 4 more recently, in the 2000s. And so you had different trajectories going into the future that you could engage people with. Okay, so this is the nub of the talk. Insights from our own energy biographies data that we've brought together so far are brought here in a particular format. You'll see that we have presented the data in the form of a cartoon animation, and that's because we did a public engagement exercise when we developed an exhibition of different ways of showing people what scientists do and what kinds of insights and data we produce. So this is a format that we've used, and I just thought I'd reproduce it here and mention that if you want to look at the film or the events and look at the kinds of interventions that we've done to engage people in creative ways, do have a look. Here, perhaps surprisingly, and raising questions about such futuristic styles of representation, not many technologies that people felt they would like in their own... There were not many technologies in these films that people wanted in their own home. Although they did see a wider utility for them in light of anticipated future change. Many people didn't like the AeroGarden, which was an indoor hydroponic system for growing food, because it divorced food growing from other relevant associations with outdoor space. So being disconnected from outdoor space meant that particular technology was a problem for some. But Jonathan sees that this technology could have wider relevance in terms of feeding an increased population globally. Dennis describes how he felt inspired by the technological visions of the future, but draws a line between gadgets that alleviate some mundane aspects of everyday life, cleaning tiles, and things that reduce autonomy and free thinking, the automatic fridge. He is explicit that this leads to dumbing down, the opposite of smart. And that's a pretty important insight, I think, for this event. So contrasting with Yolanda Strenger's work on smart utopias, we're not really talking about an overarching scepticism here, but an ambivalence, a public ambivalence, about the possibility of creating a kind of smart utopia where energy-saving technologies can enable consumers to live in ways that are resource-efficient and less environmentally damaging. Whilst the technological solutions presented in the videos of the future that we showed, the energy future, the future of the smart home we showed, were seen by some to have potential environmental and economic benefits, there were also implications in terms of wider societal costs, loneliness, disconnectedness, disintegration of the physical environment. And this is really a reflection of a methodological approach when we're asking people to reflect on things by looking at photographs that they wouldn't usually reflect on. So you do get a very nuanced account which brings in the contradictoriness of people's ideas and engagements with the energy of the future home. So here we are, and people are flying around on hoverboards and stuff, but actual cities are perceived to be dirty and people don't really care about what's going on outside. Now, these actually are extracts from the most recent Flexis work. That we've done some interviews in Cairo with a retired couple, so this is just off the press, if you like. Despite a low income, they've invested in technologies to give them greater control over their home environment, such as a Hive thermostat, allowing them to control heating remotely to ensure that their house remains at a comfortable temperature. They see that as important due to Jones Hill health. And they bought the Amazon Alexa, which Doug sees as a step towards making everything controllable from his sofa. So what we have here is a very different way of talking about smart appliances in the home to Dennis. If you remember, Dennis talked about the fridge, the technology of the fridge, being under control of the fridge, whereas here we have this desirability of being able to control everything from your sofa in a way which will be health-enhancing, potentially. Okay, my last slide. In this event, we're interested in smart technologies, smart systems, smart contracts, because of the promises that they are making to bring about a transformed future in lots of better ways. Now, obviously, that's something that I'm really interested in, but I do think we need to step back and just ask a little bit about our transformation, in what way. And actually, I hear a lot of people saying that. What are the goals? What are the outcomes? Let's be a little bit more explicit about that, so I'm not alone in this. My talk shows that the concept of energy smart futures is not without controversy. Questions opened up by what we call intangible dependencies. Sorry about this. Intangible dependencies. This is what we think is really important. For example, in the home, valuing automation over felt connection with things that make a life worth living are really important to us. We think that we really need to get under the radar and understand these intangible dependencies that are created for people when they live in a smart home, a smart world, and a changing world. So remember the importance of not feeling dumbed down by being distanced from energy infrastructure. There's something important about that sentiment. It speaks wider than the quote itself. Interestingly, we're working in a world now in energy research where new ways of conceiving energy are becoming increasingly discussed. There's an idea that we should be interested in transactive energy. This is a non-consumerist energy, and it can promote grid resilience and energy security. I've not talked about that because we're interested really in a problem which, again, complicates that sort of idea. Smart as an automation, rendering energy invisible as an object of interactions, transactive energy, doesn't really consider the sorts of things that we're interested in, how other aspects of infrastructure that are needed to make that transactive energy, that grid, a resilient smart system work, sometimes involve making dependency on energy more visible. So if you think about houses as power stations, that's premised really on making uses of energy visible, as opposed to the transactive energy approach, which sees the benefits of trading energy as if it's an invisible. It's not a commodity, there's something invisible and can be traded about it. So there's very interesting work for us going on with our engineering colleagues, where we're going to be working with them. Some specialists in power electronics and grid balancing are doing really interesting work connecting with this transactive energy idea. We're going to be working with them. But the implication of smart energy for us is that conceiving of energy less as a valuable, resource-limited commodity and something more intangible to be traded within a smart system, it poses a lot of questions for us. We see these things as good things. They're not criticisms, they're comments. They incite curiosity, and that's what we do as academic researchers. And we do think they're important to put on the stage when we're discussing smart energy futures. A final point, my first slide talked about us being interested in the social acceptability and responsible development of energy systems change. It's unlikely. Any benefit is unlikely to be one way. It isn't just to be consumers benefiting from this in a straightforward way. There are real benefits to be had from real-world public dialogue about this, and I've already heard other speakers talking about the importance of having a national or wider conversation. That's something that we're definitely interested in bringing about insofar as we can help with it. So we really think that it's important to create opportunities for reflection on questions of social acceptability and responsiveness to the kinds of smart uses of data and products which are proliferating and that potentially can transform our world for the better. But we're more likely to be able to prepare for a better future if we have the conversations now. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Karen, and such a powerful challenge to everyone involved in smart technology to carry on talking to people about how they want to use their data, how it can benefit them, how we can make sure that the kind of projects that Keith was involved with, which have connected people to their environment, to their neighbours, and to how they're using resource, can continue. And more of that to come from Dr. David Shipworth. A very warm welcome from UCL and his team. Thank you.
Right, thank you very much. So I'm going to briefly give a broader overview of this talk, which is going to be about the Energizing Health Report, which I think is scattered around with copies on the table. So we're shifting the focus slightly now to look at the potential additional benefits of smart meter data. And I think there are kind of three areas that I see as being particularly relevant here. They're kind of what I call the three killer applications for kind of smart meter data. One we've heard talked about quite a lot, which is this idea of peer-to-peer or community energy trading. And there's a lot of interest in sort of government and industry at the highest levels on that. The second one is more focused on outcome-based policy metrics. So in that context, we're working with government looking quite a lot at how we can, say, move how we rate the performance of our buildings to be based on smart meter data rather than inputs. But the third one, which we'll focus on here, is applications in the health and care area. And I must say it's been great to work with SEGB on doing this report, and I'd like to thank my team, which are authors on there. Mike Fell, my colleague's going to come up and talk through the report in a sec. And I'd like to thank you for coming. It's been interesting. I've been to a couple of events now in Wales, and I must say, of any of these type of events I've been to, I think the standard and depth of debate in Wales exceeds that I've found in other areas where I've been. I think there are a couple of important general issues to make here. People talk a lot about the digitization of energy, and they say, well, couldn't a lot of the things that we want smart meters to do outside of the energy area be done by things like mobile phones? It's important to remember that mobile phones only have about 80% penetration, and with a lot of users, their knowledge of the functionality of phones is limited, but with smart metering, we're expecting getting close to 100%. And that last 80% are people who may most benefit from potential applications and analysis of data in the health and care area. The report, it's a couple of items since doing the report. One of the companies mentioned, Houzz, which is working on this potential applications, has been acknowledged by EDF Blue Lab and has won a report. So we're starting to see the energy majors take up some of these technologies and analytical techniques to work out ways in which they can leverage smart meter data to help in terms of looking particularly after vulnerable customers. One of the major in-home display manufacturers, Geo, has teamed up with Stanner Stairlifts. So now you can get data on the activation of your Stanner Stairlift fed through your in-home display so that you can start to understand whether the activities of daily living, which are one of the key areas that we'll talk about in the report, whether those activities are ongoing and you can recognise that somebody is going about their daily activities in a way that would make you feel reassured that they're operating or they're working in their homes the way you might expect. Energy Systems Catapult is currently investing substantial amounts of money in developing an in-home display and a home energy management system functionality, which will again support a lot of these additional applications. So we're seeing investment through government vehicles, through industry, and through a lot of startups. So the report, which Michael will come and talk through in a sec, is often focused on these activities of daily living. So this is the extent to which we can use the data that comes from smart meters to understand the patterns of life that we observe in people's homes. One thing that is often done in this context is to look at this disaggregation of electricity. So can you take the data that goes into the home area network and analyze that in a way that picks up which appliances are being used, and how much do we see that as a way of helping us understand the behavior of people and the behavior of people who may have certain conditions, so, you know, increasing issues around sort of dementia or other issues which maybe we want to pick up and relate, obviously, with the consent of the people involved through to carers and supporters who may be able to then understand if people are in some level of distress in their home because they're not going about their daily activities. One final point, we're aware of a company which has now actually invested in this since the launch of this report. They're now putting on additional staff to look at applications specifically in the health and care area based on analysis of data from smart meters and load disaggregation. So from that point, if I could ask Dr. Michael Fell to come up and talk through the report in a bit more detail.
Thanks very much, David. Cheers. Thanks very much for coming as well. I'm basically going to talk a little bit more about the kind of the premise, how this actually works, using smart meter data to inform health and care. Look at some of the possible use cases that we've found or that we've thought about, and also some of the challenges that we might face in kind of getting to the point where that's feasible. So as David has kind of touched on, this is the kind of the basic logic behind using smart energy data in this way. It's that some health event happens to someone in their home which affects their behaviour in some way. If they've had a fall, for example, they're not acting in the ways in which they normally would. This, in theory, then shows up through their patterns of appliance use. They might not use certain appliances which they otherwise would have done at that time, or they might, you know, be using appliances at odd times as a result of those changes in behaviour connected with the health event. And it's in these changes in energy use patterns which are the things we're interested in using energy data in these ways. Okay, so I'm going to kind of try and illustrate this, and hopefully my animation will work, just with a very simple example from the literature around making a cup of tea. So this is imagining that you're someone who is a carer for example, an elderly relative who's living alone, perhaps with dementia, some form of dementia. And they experience some kind of health event, like they have a fall or they don't get up in the morning when would be expected. They don't use their kettle to make their cup of tea at the normal time because they're incapacitated in this way. Obviously, that shows up in terms of the electricity signature or the energy use of that kettle, which would have been expected to happen at that time. And this unusual pattern of activity prompts a message to be sent to me as the carer, letting me know, oh, you might want to check in on your mum. She's potentially got this sort of problem. So that's the sort of the basic way in which it might work. Obviously, one way in which you can do this is by looking at using a smart plug plugged into the kettle and detecting that appliance in particular. But then you'd have to go all around the house plugging these smart plugs into every appliance to be able to build up a full picture of the various activities that make up how someone might go about their life. So, and there are commercial services which use this approach, which I'll mention a few of in a bit. But what we're interested in is the potential for smart meters to, you know, given that the smart meters show the whole house energy use, to actually begin to get into using this load monitoring and disaggregation that David mentioned, recognising all these different types of appliances, washing machines, dishwashers, hair dryers, microwaves, kettles, all of which is possible when you're using data which is available from at the level which is on the home area network, which is up to 10-second data. We can recognise these things automatically from that whole house energy use. And most powerfully, when you combine that with machine learning approaches, instead of, in simple approaches, saying we expect energy use from the kettle between 9 and 10 or in the morning or 8 and 10 in the morning, you're not having to specify that anymore. These patterns can be learnt from the way in which people are going about their lives and using electricity, using machine learning. And you can start to automatically recognise when there's some departure from those patterns. So that's the basic idea behind what we're doing here. So to put this report together, basically we conducted a pretty comprehensive, we hope, review of the field. A lot of this research, well, all of it, you know, has been done pretty recently in the last 10 years or so. It's ramping up in recent years. So we are characterising this as a relatively small field, but with big ambitions at the moment. A lot of the research has been done in Europe, and mainly in, at the moment, sort of computer science, engineering-y kind of areas. That's something which I'll come on to as well in a bit. And like I mentioned, there are services commercially available that you can go out and buy at the moment, which will either include smart plugs as part of a kind of a care package to recognise these changes in activities, or even ones like David mentioned, like Howers, which doesn't use smart meter data, but it uses whole house data and is getting into this kind of machine learning area. So that's the sort of the state of the field as things stand. I'm going to read these out, because one of the things that we did as part of the report was looking at, okay, what might be some of the health-relevant symptoms or patterns that you can recognise from smart meter data. So I've already mentioned one of them, it's simply inactivity, if someone's had a fall and they're not doing anything. You can also potentially recognise sleep disturbances if you're getting unusual electricity use at night. People are getting up, for example, for more than just to go to the toilet, but getting up and cooking or using the oven. Memory problems or confusion, leaving appliances on for much too long, that could raise suspicions. Then just general, whether people are in or not, if they're out for long periods, when that would be unexpected, that's potentially something that you can identify. And also, skipping some, looking at the conditions which people might be living in. Are they heating their home to the level you might expect? Are they using the energy associated with that? Because, of course, smart meters apply just as much to gas as to electricity, although I should say a lot of the work we looked at, or all of it, was focused on electricity. Are they using the shower, for example, on a regular basis to maintain healthy living conditions? So there are these range of things that we might potentially be able to recognise. And what we tried to do was kind of map these onto a range of different conditions. So, I mean, the top one there is dementia, Alzheimer's. That's the condition which has most commonly been looked at in the research so far, and where there seems to be the most potential here, because it applies to so many of these different symptoms. But also, you know, people who are elderly and maybe generally living alone and may generally be vulnerable and in need of some sort of care provision like this. Common mental disorders like depression and anxiety can have some of these symptoms, and substance abuse. So if you take a look in the report, you'll kind of see that mapping we've done on some of the potential uses there. And I just wanted to highlight that in Wales, every year, almost £1.5 billion is spent on dementia health and care services every year. So this is obviously a very significant area of interest. And if ways can be found to kind of save or make advances there, that's going to be very important. So use cases, just to come on to some of the opportunities here. I've obviously mentioned alerts already, which is when you're sending someone a text message saying you might want to check in on this person or to a caregiver. That's already being done commercially at the moment through some of these systems that are available. We might be able to monitor the progress of conditions. So there's a stage of Alzheimer's, which is quite commonly seen, which is called sundowning, which is when people become kind of more active and agitated at night. And that can show the condition has progressed to a certain state where different sorts of care might be necessary, and it could help recognise that progression. Or obviously monitoring heating and showering, like I mentioned. Now, these are some areas where we haven't found actual evidence of work being done in these areas, but might be interesting to explore in the future. So diagnosis could be one area. There's work looking at diagnosing Parkinson's through analysing kind of the people's voices using mobile phone apps. It's this kind of unexpected data source that might give some clue as to the onset of some condition. Could energy use patterns be used in a similar way? Might be something to look into. And also this question of population level analytics. So what I haven't really mentioned so far is that all this is, on the assumption that people are consenting for their data to be used, they're signing up to these services and allowing their data to be used in these ways. So population-level analytics is going to be a challenge there, but There's interest in, for example, insomnia near airports. Could it be used as a way of mapping out insomnia around big kind of transport infrastructure developments? Or look at ways of diagnosing homes where people might benefit from having a more efficient boiler or insulation. So I'm just going to kind of speed up one a little bit because I'm running a little bit out of time here. So there are general benefits associated with doing this kind of telehealth, like keeping people out of hospital, essentially, and reducing burden on caregivers. And we think that smart meters can help potentially provide you know, some of these same benefits. But they've got additional benefits, such as being, in the years to come, nearly ubiquitous across the population of households, low cost, versatile, able to look at this range of different conditions and uses, unlike more specific and dedicated technologies. And they also have the opportunity to store 13 months of historical data. But there are also challenges. I mentioned privacy and data access, and this is something which is talked about a lot and obviously needs to be kind of at the forefront of this discussion. And there are wider acceptance issues around telehealth in general. Is this something that health practitioners and care organisations have concerns about? You know, this is going to be a lot of data coming in. How are we going to make use of it? Also, some of the things which Karen alluded to around this lack of human contact, which might be a potential risk, which we need to kind of be aware of. So there needs to be more work in that. There are technical issues around recognising appliances from that kind of whole house energy use and being able to associate electricity use with the actual appliances that people are using, getting the ground truth of so that you can do that machine learning which I mentioned. And then regulatory issues. At the moment, smart meters, they're just kind of fully in the energy domain. What happens when these become a health technology? What does that mean for how reliable they need to be? Or if you're doing research around them, colleagues that we worked with or who were very helpful in the development of this report have been developing a project in Liverpool with NHS Merseycare. And, you know, so a great example of work actually being done on the ground in this area, but the ethics process, because they had to go through the health ethics process, was incredibly arduous and, not something that was not familiar to them as engineers. Just to close, I think one thing that we noticed is, like I said, lots of interest in this field, but at the moment, not really very much in terms of clinical research, and that's ultimately what kind of health professionals are interested in. Does this work? Has it got the proof behind it? So we need bigger trials, and we need more trials to show that this works. I actually noticed that there is funding available at the moment through the Welsh Government, through the Efficiency Through Technology Fund in the health area, which is offering up to £200,000 to develop and scale technological innovation in the health area. So if anyone's interested in this area, I think it closes in August sometime. Take a look at that, I'd recommend. More interdisciplinary work, bring in people from health and care professions and sectors. Take it out of just the engineering departments and the computing departments. Start getting industry involved as well. I'll skip over a couple of these. I've talked about user acceptance, which we need to do more research on. But finally, just to say, smart meters are just going to be one part of this broader ecosystem, which we've heard a lot about, of Internet of Things devices, which themselves will be able to measure temperature in homes or how much you're running and all these different things. You know, they've all got their part to play. So it's important to consider what the role of this technology will be as part of that wider ecosystem and think about that piece as well. I'll finish there. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David and Michael, for all the work you've done on this project. Many of you here and on the table I was talking to, a guest from Citizens Advice and many others of you have raised the question of the people who often need help are sometimes those who are least likely to ask for it. Certainly that's been true in the past in energy, in a previous analogue world where nobody knows if a home has been cut off. Often it is the people who are most in need of that problem to be answered quickly who assume that someone's on the case and it's being fixed, when actually in a pre-smart world that's not the case. So smart opens up the potential to target support for people, fuel efficiency support, fuel poverty, in a way that has not been previously possible. But within the context of Karen's very powerful questions about what this means for society and us and individuals and how much data we want to share and what the protections can be around that. So thank you all. Questions? Yes, we have a mic on its way to you, I think. Do introduce yourself, thank you.
My name is Mohammed Akhtaruzzaman. My question is about the automation. Those who are in favor of total automation, I disagree with them, because automation undoubtedly good for us, for the society, for the future generation, but it has got mixed blessings as well. Now, can you imagine full automation? What will happen to youngsters 24, 25 years out of the university with degrees, and their jobs will be taken over by technology? What would happen to those who rely on total automation, guests coming into your front door, calling the bell, you are not going to the front door to answer the door, you are pressing the button to let the guest in. Can you imagine, the high street will be no man land sort of things, and there will be no social activities. So these are the few examples of total automation I'm against of. Now, I think, automation, there should be a line drawn. You know, how much automation we need, what are the relevant benefits we can get out of that, and what are the disadvantages, we'll face with total automation?
Such an important question. I mean, one governments across the world are grappling with, and I know the panel will have some thoughts on. Do you want to address these now? Shall I just continue?
And also, for instance, obesity things, another thing, People will suffer from obesity, and that will be additional burden for the National Health Services. There are so many, I can give examples, but these are few. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Karen, do you want to...
Sure, yeah, thank you very much for that. I think it's really nice that you've picked up one of the dilemmas, if you like, of engaging people to talk about things that really matter to them in their lives. And when very strong value statements come out. I don't think we're really trying to peddle this argument that there's an issue with automaticity as a value statement, although it would be interesting to think of it in those terms. I think my concern is that when you engage members of the public and you hear them talk about things that matter to them, the terms that they use are really laden with meaning. And in relation to automation, I think the meaning to me for smart energy futures has something along the lines of, if people are promised with automation that their complex lives will be made more simple, this could pose a form of cruel optimism, I would call it. So we do need to think in very complex ways about the things that people are telling us. It isn't about being moralising or making absolute judgments. As you've said, it isn't that all automation is bad. It's not a total badness. But we do need to think about the consequences down the line as our society changes in these massive ways. And when people tell us that automation is an issue, the alarm bells ring with me if they're being promised something and they're not going to, that promise is not going to be delivered on. Because to me, a smart energy future is not going to necessarily enable people to live in a more simple world. The world is a complex world. And so the messaging of this is actually quite important. So thank you very much for raising it.
Thank you. David, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think this forms part of a much wider societal debate. There's a lot of debate at the moment about the potential impact of artificial intelligence in replacing very large parts of the workforce that are in effectively service or clerical applications. So I think there are implications in the energy area. I personally think that a level of automation is going to be both appreciated, and this partly comes from some work that Mike's done around this, where we see greater acceptance of things like demand-side response when it's accompanied by automation. But I also think that that there is a dystopian future in which automation effectively turns us into some kind of very inanimate people who sit on couches and just do everything by buttons. I don't think that will probably come to pass, or it won't come to pass in a very widespread way. So I think we do need automation. If I'm sending an email, the last thing I want to do is to define the set of routers through which my email is split up and sent globally to arrive on the other side of the planet. I have no interest in doing that. Likewise, if I would like to be able to tell my, you know, my home that I want it to be at a certain temperature, I don't want to sit down and do all the complicated calculations to work out when the heating has to come on to get it to that temperature by that time, given the thermal inertia of my property and the expected weather tomorrow. I'm not interested in any of that. So I want automation to deliver some aspects of this. So I think there's part of a wider societal debate. I think automation plays an important role, but it must be, again, consented by the consumers. And we need to keep a very clear eye on unintended consequences.
Thank you. At the back, thank you.
So for the grid of the future, changes need to happen to the grid right away. There's changes that need to happen now. But what role can the consumer have when these are really complex challenges which are hard to understand and prioritise? And a lot of these changes will help make an energy system cheaper in the future. But for a consumer, they may have to deal with the energy service differently or make changes. So how do we get the consumer involved in this discussion, even though it's so complex?
Thank you for that. Karen, any thoughts on what the conversation might look like that you've described?
Well, it's that million-dollar question, really. And I would say that we're trying to configure all the options right now. And we're in a very experimental place. So I'm a social scientist, but I've been now working in close collaboration with arts scholars, performance artists, creative conceptual artists, to try and make the kinds of issues that arise for us when we're doing research on energy demand reduction, to engage people in the science of it. So if you look on our Energy Biographies website, you can see a film we've made of how we've tried to do this. Now, for us, it's stepping out of our comfort zone, because what we're entertaining is the idea that to engage people, we can't just tell people exactly what it is that we want them to talk about. We use a more oblique approach. This is something that you tend to associate with a more arts-associated way of engaging people in performance. We have found that we can come up with some new formats which are working quite well for us, and the Welsh Government have liked it when we've talked to them about it. We've done strange things such as ask artists to do performances in a public space, in a community space, and then we'll have a focused discussion facilitated by an energy expert about the issues that they can now come at, piqued by their curiosity about the arts performance. Now, to me, that sounds quite strange. But I do think we've got to get out of the usual, the business as usual idea. If we're going to ask people to engage with these complex issues about things that are often intangible, difficult to think about, may or may not happen, etc., where they sometimes feel as if they're being burdened with too much complexity and too much change, I think we have got to be thinking outside the box. Sorry, that's the best I can do.
I just made two quick points. I mean, firstly, I think the community energy option is, you know, one obvious way to do that. I think it's great the work that Keith has talked about, and the organisations like Community Energy Wales and England and Repowering there are doing, and that seems one obvious way to make it much more tangible and to have those sort of discussions with people you kind of know and who live nearby. Just to bring in, you know, some of the work which we were talking about, I think, you know, it's these unexpected areas like health associated with a smart meter. Like, who would have thought of that? Who would have thought that, you know, my grandma, for example, would be getting a consumer access device or keen to, you know, getting that in the home and therefore open to the sort of services which might then be offered on the energy side. You're having these discussions by virtue of other benefits which are coming in for completely non-energy related reasons. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of people in the industry are interested in this as well, because it's a whole package. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I have been just reminded that we need to keep to time, and I hope we'll have lots more time for discussion on tables. So may I now introduce workshop two, about a key, and we'd love to get a final slice of your thoughts on the key opportunities for Wales, but in particular, what do we need to do to help ensure that people's data privacy is considered and protected? And what about particularly for Wales? What are the key opportunities for Wales as a leader in the transition to the smart energy future? So thank you very much, and we will reconvene a little after 12:35. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody, for a fantastic, really fascinating and inspiring morning. It was great to talk to you on our table about the particular challenges Wales faces in regard to energy, around fuel poverty and rurality, but conversely, the opportunities and the expertise, therefore, in galvanising communities, bringing in new technology for the benefit of all, as well as some of the trickier questions about the wider benefits of smart technology, and if smart unlocks those benefits, how do we make decisions about how to invest in it and which budgets that comes from, and how therefore the resulting benefits can be enjoyed by us all. So really interesting discussion. We are going to be collating the outtakes from all of your discussions, so please do leave the pieces of paper that you've gathered your thoughts on the table. We'll be publishing a report bringing together all of those thoughts and opinions and advice. My very great thanks to the Institute for Welsh Affairs, to Oriel and her team, and many of the views you've expressed today are also going to become part of their work going forward. A couple of final housekeeping points, as well as leaving the pieces of paper on the table which gathered your thoughts, would you also please leave the translation device? Some kind of accessory, possibly, but actually no other use. We will be emailing evaluations of this morning to everybody, and I'd be very grateful to hear what you have thought of the morning. And I hope very much to keep in touch with you all and come back and talk about a smart future in Wales very soon. Thank you very much.